always meant hate. It meant hate was when I was in high school. I have no problem with you wearing your flag if you want to wear it on your t-shirt. I have a problem with it standing in front of what is supposed to be our state house, grounds. That's a problem because it may mean heritage to you, but if it means hate to me, it doesn't diminish what it means to me. It still means oppression. It still means hate. It still means slavery. And that's not going to change.
Tamika, was there a discussion about whether to wait for the South Carolina legislature to take their time in a debate?
So we've noticed that they've been pushing it off for a very long time, since everything started to happen, and we just didn't have time for it, basically. I think that's how we summarize and use that, right? It's ambiguous, right? They're going to wait, they're going to take it to House, and they're going to stop, and then they're going to come back to it. And it might have not been until the end of July, August, and then we don't even know what they're going to rule. So the country will be waiting around to figure out what it is, and they might not even favor and the removal of the flag.
Tamika Lewis, Carol Parker, and Corinne Mack speaking outside the jail in Columbia, South Carolina. Bree Newsom and Jimmy Tyson were both released from jail on Saturday afternoon after supporters posted the requisite $300 of their $3,000 bond each. Their next court appearance is July 27th in Columbia, South Carolina. A very special thanks to my colleagues working with me in South Carolina, John Hamilton and Amy Littlefield. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to John Randolph and to Karen Renucci. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, and Malcolm Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Supreme Court rules in favor of lethal injections.
Alaska wildfires break previous records with 2.2 million acres burned.
Flotilla of humanitarian aid to Gaza Strip has been stopped and captured by the Israeli military.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 19th, 2015. I'm Ryan Stroyer.
And I'm Ethan Martin. A humanitarian aid ship was seized by the Israeli Navy today in the Mediterranean Sea. The ship was part of the Freedom Flotilla ship attempting to break the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip, which has crippled the economy of Gaza and led to unemployment rates of up to 80%. At least 18 journalists and activists were abducted by the Israeli military during the raid by the Israeli military. The attack on the Marianne occurred approximately 100 miles from the Gazan Strip in international waters. The ship originated in Sweden, but carried activists and political leaders from around the world. Three other boats in the flotilla turned back towards Greece after the raid on the Marianne. Altogether, the four ships involved in the flotilla carried almost 50 people from 17 different countries. We will have an interview with one of the organizers of the Freedom Flotilla later this hour at 5:45 on KBOO News in Depth, so stay tuned for that following this newscast.
The Oregonians for 15 Coalition plans to deliver over 2,000 signatures to the Oregon Capitol tomorrow. The coalition includes more than 30 labor and community organizations, pushing legislators to raise Oregon's minimum wage to $15 an hour. I spoke with Justin Norton Kirsten from 15 Now Oregon.
Most of what we do is centered around community education and organizing around getting a $15 minimum wage for the state of Oregon, and becoming the first state to win a $15 minimum wage. So we're out at community events. You know, we recently were in the Pride Parade and down at the Good in the Hood Parade. We're out at last Thursday talking to people about the issue and why the minimum wage needs to be raised, telling them stories about, you know, the working people who are out there that aren't able to pay their bills because they don't make enough.
Do you think you could tell me one of those stories?
Yeah, sure. You know, Ashley, for example, she lives out in the Hillsboro, Alloa area. She's got two kids. She's been working in low-wage, you know, sort of service and retail sector jobs her whole life. She's gone back to school, to beauty school, to be a hairstylist. And she struggles every day to, you know, to pay for school, to pay for housing and bills for her kids, food for her kids. And she, you know, she needs a raise. She works really hard, and she shouldn't have to work so hard and only to fall so far behind every day.
So tell me about this petition.
Yeah, so back in April, 15 Now Oregon and Cocoon, the Farm Workers Union, and the Rural Organizing Project filed a ballot measure for a $15 minimum wage in Oregon, started the petition committee called Oregonians for 15. So for the last couple months, we've been busy collecting the first sponsoring signatures for that. I have to collect 1,000 valid signatures in order to get a ballot title. And then at that point, we can go ahead and collect the rest of the signatures that we need. So tomorrow, actually, we're going to be submitting our first couple thousand signatures in order to kickstart that process.
Awesome. And can you tell me a little bit more about the events surrounding the submission of the first set of signatures?
Yeah, so we'll be down in Salem tomorrow at 10 o'clock at the steps of the Capitol building. We'll be holding a press conference there where members from different organizations like 15 Now Oregon and Pacoon and Rural Organizing Project, Jobs with Justice, the Oregon School Employees Association, will all be there and we'll all be saying something about the $15 minimum wage and how it affects the different constituencies and different people that they work with. And then we'll be marching right across the street to the State Elections Division office to submit the first 2,000 signatures that we've actually collected signatures from all 36 counties across the state. So we really feel like this first round of signatures is representative of the whole state of Oregon and the fact that everybody needs a $15 minimum wage, not just people in Portland.
How many Oregonians would be affected by a $15 minimum wage?
Sure. If 15 passed, there would be about 586,000 people in the state of Oregon who would be directly affected and who would get a raise. And actually, there are 350,000 kids in the state of Oregon who have at least one parent who will get a raise if 15 passes. So it's a really significant number. It's really going to do a lot to help lift up working people here in the state of Oregon.
That was Justin Norton Kirsten of 15 Now Oregon about their demonstration on the Capitol steps tomorrow at 10 a.m.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
If T-Mobile would simply allow a policy of neutrality and simply allow the people to form a union if they want to, then they would. We have a long road ahead of us. We have a lot of support. I really feel like it's a campaign that we can win. And I think that it would be a lot better for all people involved if we did actually get a union voice.
T-Mobile worker and Communications Workers of America supporter Paul Rose. Pro-union workers at T-Mobile attempting to organize are running into anti-union tactics, even though the parent company's German operations are union. In March, a National Labor Relations Board judge found T-Mobile guilty of using illegal anti-union policies. The judge ordered T-Mobile to rescind the illegal labor practices affecting 40,000 workers. Rose says there are other issues at T-Mobile that are fueling the union effort.
Your vacation and your sick time is all together. So if you get sick, you basically forfeit your vacation. So it makes it impossible to pre-plan a vacation for 6 months down the road with your family. Also, just disparity in pay. Up until recently, T-Mobile had a policy of not allowing workers to discuss how much they make. Recently, with the help of CWA, they have been found guilty of various things with the NLRB, and that's one of the policies that now they are having to make a change on.
The Chicago Teachers Union says talks are broken with no new labor agreement. The old contract expires Tuesday. CTU President Karen Lewis says rather than make a deal, Chicago Public Schools is making threats. Lewis says Chicago teachers are insulted by the punitive proposals and corporate-driven directives from the Chicago Public Schools. The union says it's willing to remain, though, at the bargaining table to reach a new labor agreement. U.S. workers will be bargaining new contracts at big companies this summer. In this WIN News Analysis, executive producer Frank Emspach poses a key question.
Summer 2015 means that contracts with the major unionized wealth-producing companies of the United States are underway or at the verge of completion. General Electric, the Big Three, Verizon, AT&T, and Basic Steel all face their workers this summer. We say wealth-producing because the workers in these firms produce tremendous wealth. The question in all bargaining is, will the workers get their fair share? Will compensation, including benefits, exceed inflation and keep pace with increasing productivity? If the answer is yes, that means that the real standard of living of working people represented by these unions will increase. Historically, when such was the case, all workers benefit. Although there are specific issues in each of these industries, it does appear that the long 20-year imposition of concessions is at an end. Whether there will be gains is another question. We'll address that issue next week. For Workers Independent News, I'm executive producer Frank Emspach.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Board of Directors of the Multnomah Education Service District has voted unanimously to approve two unrelated separation agreements totaling more than $305,000. In order to avoid a lawsuit, the Education Service District paid former Superintendent Barbara Jorgensen more than $166,000. The second-year superintendent has been on leave and working off-site since February, when the eight school districts that comprise the Multnomah Education Service District all voted to remove Jorgensen from her position. The second separation agreement involved special ed teacher Brett Bingham, Oregon's 2014 Teacher of the Year. Bingham was placed on leave by the district after they charged that he had missed too many days of school attending award ceremonies related to his Teacher of the Year award. Bingham responded by filing several complaints, claiming that the district engaged in disparate treatment because of his sexual orientation. The district admitted no wrongdoing, but paid Bingham $140,000. Bingham was the nation's first openly gay teacher to be declared Teacher of the Year and had received numerous awards and speaking engagements as a result of that accomplishment.
Four more funerals were held this past week for the victims of the Charleston church shooting that left 9 people dead earlier this month. In related news, on Saturday morning, 30-year-old activist Bree Newsom climbed the flagpole in front of the South Carolina Capitol and removed the Confederate flag that was flying. Newsom and another activist were arrested on misdemeanor charges of defacing a state monument. The Confederate flag was raised shortly thereafter by South Carolina state officials. As she made her way up the flagpole using a harness and climbing gear, police told her to come down. When she reached the top, she shouted, "You came against me with hatred and oppression and of violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today."
Ma'am, come down off the pole. Ma'am, come down off the pole. Off the pole. Ma'am. Ma'am. Go.
Be out. Go home.
You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today.
I'm
going to
comply. I promise you. I'm coming down. I'm prepared to be arrested.
But I don't want to comply. I'm coming down.
That That was activist Bree Newsom getting arrested in South Carolina yesterday for scaling a flagpole and removing the Confederate flag. In a statement released to the Blue Nation Review following her arrest, Bree Newsom wrote, "It is important to remember that our struggle doesn't end when the flag comes down. The Confederacy is a Southern thing, but white supremacy is not. Our generation has taken up the banner to fight battles many thought were won long ago, but we must fight with all our vigor now so that our grandchildren aren't still fighting these battles in another 50 years.
There has been widespread public outrage over grand juries failing to indict police officers for misconduct in several recent killings of unarmed men, including in New York City and Ferguson, Missouri. Many who believed the officers were guilty hoped that, even if the officers escaped criminal responsibility, at least civil penalties would bring justice and accountability. But new research shows that while civil suits against police misconduct have a much better chance of winning a verdict against officers in question, those suits are unlikely to change police department policies, and they rarely affect officers who committed the acts. Free Speech Radio news reporter Larry Boole has more from Los Angeles.
Joanna Schwartz is an assistant professor at UCLA Law School. She analyzed thousands of civil rights settlements from 44 large and 37 small and medium-sized police departments from 2006 to 2011. She found that officers are almost always protected from paying money a court might award a victim as a result of the officer's actions. In large cities, Schwartz found that individual officers paid out only a tiny fraction of 1% of all the settlement money in cases filed against police, and nothing at all in smaller cities. And Schwartz found something else very surprising. In the vast majority of cases she reviewed, the police departments didn't even know how much their city was paying in damages and didn't even make the effort to learn from those lawsuits.
When a lawsuit is filed, the city attorney or the county attorney will generally handle the case. Any money paid in those cases generally comes out of the city or county's central budget. And no information is kept by the law enforcement agency about which officers were named, what claims were alleged, what information came out during discovery, what the resolution was of the case, or how much was paid.
Schwartz says that information may reside somewhere in the city bureaucracy, but is unlikely to reach supervisors who could analyze the data and learn what lessons it might offer. Police accountability professionals say these results confirm what they've seen for years. A tort system that sometimes benefits the victims of police misconduct, always benefits the attorneys, and rarely leads to meaningful reform. Cynthia Anderson Barker is a civil rights and criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles. She tells FSRN she's happy to win damage claims for her clients, but frustrated to see major law enforcement problems go unchanged. She says the opaque and defensive culture of police is partly to blame, and she puts part of the blame with lawyers.
There is a problem with lawyers when we litigate these cases. The lawyers on the other side that are often hired by the city, contract lawyers, they're paid by the hour. And these lawyers have no incentive to settle these cases early on or to fix or reform the problem that is causing us to sue the city or the public entity.
She says even when a claim seeks injunctive relief, that's a demand for policy changes as part of the lawsuit, and the police agree, often it's still business as usual. In 2000, Anderson Barker and her partners sued LAPD for opening fire on protesters and bystanders with hard rubber bullets outside a Democratic National Committee event. The city eventually paid out $4.1 million in damages and lawyer fees, and in addition to the money, the court also issued an injunction prohibiting the LAPD from shooting people with rubber bullets and beanbags and using batons for crowd control. But 7 years later, at a May Day celebration, LAPD ignored the injunction and used the same procedures.
The police opened fire in the park with the rubber bullets, also with baton strikes, injuring scores of innocent folks. And that case was settled for $12.6 million, a huge hit the city took.
Police reform advocates point out another reason why civil suits are ineffective in changing police policies. The U.S. Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court has made it extremely difficult for individuals to bring litigation to actually seek the kind of reforms that cause them to get harmed. They can only seek compensation.
Jonathan Smith is Associate Dean of Experimental and Clinical Programs at the University of District Columbia School of Law. He points to a 1983 case, the City of Los Angeles versus Lyons, brought after Los Angeles police officers, under the department's then-prevailing policy, placed the plaintiff, Adolph Lyons, in a chokehold following a traffic stop.
They went all the way to the Supreme Court, and what the Supreme Court said in Lyons was he didn't have standing to challenge the policy. He could get compensated, but he didn't have standing to actually force them to change the policy because he couldn't prove the policy was going to be used against him again. So he didn't have a dog in the fight of what happened going forward. And that decision in Lyons interrupted a long string of cases where an individual was able to leverage what happened to them to the greater good.
Right now, the most effective tool for reform, and one that's used only in the most egregious cases of misconduct, is the consent decree. The Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division can issue a consent decree to any law enforcement organization that shows pattern and practice of using excessive force or violating people's civil rights and force them to change a policy. Consent decrees were initiated in response to the Rodney King beating in 1991 and have been issued most recently against police departments in Ferguson, Missouri, Cleveland, and Baltimore in the wake of killings of unarmed black men. But even a consent decree is no guarantee of long-term change.
Federal consent decrees, the effectiveness of them depends on the people who are enforcing the consent decree or not enforcing the consent decree, and it depends on the leadership of the police department.
Joe Dominic is Associate Director of the Center on Media Crime and Justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the author of the upcoming book, Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. He says consent decrees are the best tool for reform right now, but he admits that the Justice Department can't use them everywhere. And because of stringent requirements against using them against individual officers, consent decrees are usually only effective against whole departments. But Dominic is optimistic that the worst law enforcement policies will be reformed, just not as a result of big civil suits. He says it will stem from public pressure.
So you have a new generation of journalists now who think that this is wrong, you know, that what's been going on for the last 30 years is wrong. A lot of those young people are for police reform, which wasn't the case in the 70s and 80s and 90s, when a majority of white people wanted the police to be tough.
Dominic and other police reform advocates say that while more Americans are starting to understand what needs to change, whether and how fast those changes will happen remains to be seen. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with David Heap with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla after this newscast at 5:45. The Freedom Flotilla is an attempt by humanitarian aid workers and activists to break the Israeli siege on Gaza. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, bringing you the latest news on the struggles of working people here in Oregon. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. On tonight's show, Carlos Chavez pops in to host another special edition of a McLaren Community Voice, featuring the radio journalism students at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. The youth report on the Right Around Portland readings and a special visit to the McLaren facility by guests from New Birth Crew and True Roots. McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, located in Woodburn, is Oregon's largest youth correctional facility. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with highs of 89, and Wednesday is with sunny with highs of 94. Today in history, in 1888, George Edward Gorod recorded Handel's Israel in Egypt onto a phonograph cylinder. This is thought to be the oldest known recording of audio. And in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Furman v. Georgia that arbitrary and inconsistent application of the death penalty violated the Constitution and was cruel and unusual punishment. This resulted in a de facto moratorium on the death penalty nationwide until a Supreme Court ruling in 1976 reinstated the death penalty. The quote of the day is from Russian-American novelist and author of Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov, who said, "I think it is all a matter of love. The more you love a memory, the stronger and stranger it is."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
"Wow," exclaimed a beaming Donald Trump as he stepped on stage, basking in the cheers of a throng attending his launch into the 2016 presidential race. "That is some group of people," he gushed, "thousands." It was a showbiz extravaganza, literally. The crowd was cheering the self-promoting hypester who wants to be president, but not necessarily supporting him. That's because some of these over-the-top enthusiasts were actors. Yes, hired at $50 a pop to do a 3-hour gig as Donnie's crowd. Extra Mile Casting had been retained to puff up the audience. We are looking to cast people for the event to wear T-shirts and carry signs and help cheer him, said Extra Mile in an email to its list of actors who work as extras in films, TV shows, etc. When the Donald Show was over, the extras dumped their signs in the trash and went to their next acting gig. For his part, Trump delivered a rambling, almost incoherent 40-minute rant. Citing his chief qualification for the highest office in our land, he said, "I'm really rich. And by the way, I'm not even saying that in a braggadocious. That's the kind of thinking you need for this country." And his immigration policy is simply, well, simplistic. "I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me." Wow, apparently he intends to build the wall himself. Then he added a jingoistic gringoism to this good neighbor policy, declaring, "And I'll have Mexico pay for that wall." And what's his economic policy, you ask? It's a whopper. "I will be the greatest jobs president God ever created," he bellowed. This is Jim Hightower saying, "No, no, Donnie, don't even try to blame God for creating you or your nuttiness. You truly are a self-made man, spawned from the fumes of your own gaseous ego. Yet, you're a godsend for those of us seeking comic relief in politics."
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Close to 2 million acres of forest have burned in Alaska so far this year. This breaks any previous record for the number and extent of wildfires for any year up to this point. There are currently 314 wildfires burning in Alaska. As analyst Robert Scribler points out, with just one day left in June and more than 300 fires still active, it's pretty clear that the current fire season is an historic, unprecedented, record-shattering event. This year's record burning of forests in Alaska is set to double the previous record of June fires in Alaska, which was set in 2004. This excessive new record is occurring in the ominous context of the hottest year in the global climate record. As Alaska burned through 500,000 acres of forest in just one day last week, a massive heat wave was also setting off extreme wildfires throughout northwest Canada. It was the same heat wave that broke new temperature records all across Washington and the mountains in western Canada. Temperatures in places like Walla Walla, Washington hit 113 degrees on Sunday, breaking the previous all-time June temperature record for the day by 4 degrees. A pulse of heat is rising off the back of a strengthening El Niño in the Pacific, running all the way up the western seaboard and driving deep into northwestern Canada. According to Scribler, it appears that the same excessive heat, dryness, and permafrost thaw that has set off record fires for Alaska during June is now also in play for Canada. Initial reports from Canada's Interagency Fire Center confirm this assessment, with 138 new fires erupting in just the past 24 hours alone, and more than 2.2 million acres burned for the country since the start of 2015.
Facing record low water supplies and a dry summer ahead, some California farmers are getting creative in looking for new sources of water. In one community, they're planning to buy water from cities, after it's already been used. Lauren Summers with the California Report has more.
For a lot of Californians, the drought may be just a nuisance. For Anthea Hansen, it's been crazy.
Crazy wouldn't adequately describe what we're going through here.
To see why, she takes me right outside her office door.
So the field across the street is about 350 acres. This land would typically be farmed in probably tomatoes.
Instead, the field is empty, fallowed because there's no water. And that's Hansen's problem. She runs the Del Puerto Water District near Modesto, and it's her job to deliver water to this farm and 150 others in the Central Valley.
Having zero water available, we've been in survival and crisis mode for literally 24 months now.
Hansen's district relies on federal reservoirs in the state, but that supply has been cut off. The district doesn't have rights to local rivers. There isn't much groundwater to pump. And buying water on the open market is expensive. What her district needs, she says, is a reliable supply that's there, drought or no drought. Turns out, that's closer than you might think.
I hope it doesn't smell too bad to you.
Not too bad.
It's kind of an earthy smell. It's not totally offensive.
Will Wong is giving me a tour of Modesto's wastewater treatment plant. The city is a couple hours east of San Francisco. Everything that goes down the drain in Modesto, from 240,000 people, ends up here. Sewage may not seem like an obvious water source, but...
water is water. As long as it's wet, it's water, and it's valuable.
And it goes through a transformation. The treatment plant is getting new equipment that will disinfect the wastewater with ultraviolet light. Normally, it would then be discharged into the San Joaquin River, as much as 14 million gallons a day. But Modesto had an idea. Maybe someone else would want to buy it.
Del Porto Water District raised their hand as quickly as they brought the question up, and we've been partnering with them ever since.
The idea is to build a 6-mile pipeline to carry the wastewater from the city to a canal that goes to farms in the Del Porto Water District. It would be the largest urban-to-ag water recycling project in the state.
I can't tell you how great I think this project is.
That's Anthea Hansen again.
And I really, 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 truly hope that we can bring it across the line because it will be a model for others.
She says the water would be expensive, 4 to 5 times normal prices, but that's the cost of reliability. Growers like Jim Jasper are more than willing to pay.
Most farmers are internal optimists, and I like to be optimistic, but without something like this, a future for my son and grandson and family, and we're into this third generation, and I don't know if we can keep our business going.
Other agricultural areas are taking notice as they face their own drought shortfalls.
There's absolutely more potential for recycled water use in California.
Heather Cooley is with the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit water think tank in Oakland. She says California could be using 2 to 3 times more recycled water, but there are potential problems. For one, keeping wastewater out of a river could impact the river itself.
You need to understand where that water would have gone. Is it providing important environmental flows? Is it providing water to a downstream community such that if you're recycling it, there's no longer water for that community?
That's the case for Modesto. Farmers in a nearby water district are concerned the plan will change flows in the San Joaquin River. And in other parts of the Central Valley, location is a problem. It's expensive to move wastewater long distances, and a lot of Central Valley farms are just too far from big cities.
It's not the single silver bullet solution for agriculture. Agriculture is going to have to do a lot of things to adapt to a future of less water availability.
In the Del Puerto Water District, farmers see water recycling as a way to survive that future. The project still needs a slew of permits from the state, but if all goes well, the taps could open up in just 3 years. I'm Lauren Summer, KQED News.
In related news, researchers from NASA and the University of California have released a report showing that at least 1/3 of the world's largest aquifers are in serious decline. The report studied 37 of the world's largest aquifers and found that many will be depleted within the next decade or two. Among the worst-stressed aquifers are the Arabian Aquifer System, the Indus Basin Aquifer in India and Pakistan, and the Merzouq-Jado Aquifer in North Africa. Groundwater aquifers replenish slowly over thousands of years, but are being rapidly and unsustainably depleted by human usage. Researchers believe that aquifers located in areas that grow food for up to half the world's population could be depleted within the next 20 years.
The community of Grant Township, Pennsylvania, has recently voted in favor of a controversial ordinance. Called the Community Constitution, the new law forbids Pennsylvania General Energy Company from drilling a wastewater injection well 7 miles from a local watershed. The well would have been used for the disposal of liquid waste from hydraulic fracturing, better known to many as fracking. Grant Township acknowledges the ordinance is likely to be challenged and difficult to defend. A little-known activist group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund backed Grant Township's action, as well as a number of actions elsewhere. In an interview with Reuters, the group's founder said that, quote, "Our premise is that you can't win against the oil and gas industry using the existing legal structure, so the structure has to be changed." The fund has not yet won any of the cases which challenged ordinances like Grant Township's, but that's okay, they say. Their main goal is to start a vigorous debate within the judiciary and raise people's consciousness of the issue.
Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton has characterized the Supreme Court's ruling that all states must permit same-sex marriage as lawless, and has said that state workers may deny gay couples a marriage license based on their religious beliefs. He warned state workers that they could face litigation or fines if they denied marriage licenses to gay couples but said that numerous lawyers stand ready to provide free legal assistance to those who choose to do so. Paxton's opinion is that the Supreme Court's ruling can coexist with Texans' religious freedoms and freedom of speech. He instructed state authorities that they may not take any adverse actions against state employees acting on their religious beliefs. Although many Republicans have voiced opposition to the Supreme Court's endorsement of gay marriage, the vast majority across the nation say they will respect the court's ruling.
In one of three major rulings handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court today, the justices ruled that lethal injections do not constitute cruel and unusual punishment. The court decided the use of a controversial sedative for lethal injections would continue to be allowed. Free Speech Radio news reporter Janie Actman has more from Washington, D.C.
Somber describes the mood outside the Supreme Court Monday morning when the justices dealt a blow to death penalty abolitionists. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled against three death row prisoners in Oklahoma who sought to ban a controversial drug during lethal injections. The drug, called midazolam, is a sedative intended to put prisoners into a coma-like state during executions. But the inmates argued that the chemical can't reliably induce the state of unconsciousness that would prevent them from feeling the painful impact of two other drugs in the three-drug lethal injection. They pointed to three botched lethal injection cases last year. In one case, an Oklahoma prisoner awoke during his execution after being injected with midazolam.
It's sickening.
That's Bill Pelkey, the director of the Journey for Hope From Violence to Healing, an organization led by murder victim family members who oppose the death penalty. Pelkey is against all forms of the death penalty, especially those that he considers cruel and unusual.
And that drug obviously is not effective, and I don't know why the Supreme Court is saying it's okay. I don't understand it at all.
Writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Alito Jr. explained that the plaintiffs failed to show an available and preferable alternative to midazolam. He also wrote that the prisoners didn't demonstrate that the drug showed a substantial risk of severe pain. Oklahoma and other states that execute prisoners argued that banning the drug would effectively prevent lethal injections. Many chemical manufacturers, under pressure from anti-death penalty advocates, have stopped providing other drugs used to induce unconsciousness during executions. Richard Dieter, senior program director at Death Penalty Information Center, says that the decision won't have a huge impact on states' use of lethal injections.
It is not a glowing endorsement of midazolam. That remains a risky drug for the purposes of execution. It merely says that there was not enough evidence to find it unconstitutional. So I think many states will look for alternative drugs.
But Dieter did say that the dissenting justices raised a big question about the death penalty itself. In his dissent, Justice Stephen Breyer asked the court to consider the issue as a whole. Janie Actman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Supreme Court upheld a voter-approved initiative to allow congressional districts in Arizona to be drawn up by an independent commission. The commission's authority was challenged by Arizona State Republicans seeking to establish that the authority to draw up districts rests constitutionally in the hands of the state legislature. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, argued that the Constitution does not refer to a specific legislative body when guaranteeing the right of legislators to draw electoral boundaries, but rather to the state's general authority to legislate on an issue, which could include voter-backed initiatives. The voter-backed initiative was approved in 2000, but was challenged by Arizona Republicans after they lost all House seats in 2012 to Democrats. Supporters of the ruling argued that an independent commission ensures that competitive and diverse districting and limits the effect of gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is the intentional redrawing of districts in often unusual shapes to favor one political party.
The Supreme Court also voted 5-4 along party lines to halt further implementation of the Obama administration's 2011 regulations controlling emissions of mercury and other toxins from coal-fired power plants. The court ruled that the EPA failed to consider the financial costs to upgrade power plants when implementing new regulations. The court did not rule the law was illegal, but stated that health risks cannot be the only consideration when issuing new regulations. Analysis has shown that the new rules would cost almost $10 billion per year to implement, but would save between $40 and $90 billion per year in healthcare costs. The vast majority of power plants affected are located in the South and Upper Midwest.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Media East's Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, June 29th, 2015. Israeli troops take over siege-busting ship heading to Gaza, and troops kidnap civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israel's Navy has boarded and taken over an activist ship seeking to break its Gaza blockade and escorted it to Ashdod Israeli port on Monday. According to Israeli sources, the taking over of the boat was done without any injuries among the unarmed human rights activists. The Swedish boat, which on Sunday afternoon was 150 nautical miles from the Gaza coast, was carrying 20 activists, among them member of the Israeli Knesset Bassel Gattas of the Joint Arab List and former Tunisian President Monsef Marzouki. The Israeli army said that all activists will be deported back to their countries. Organizers of the Gaza Flotilla 3 said that more ships will be deporting from Greece to Gaza in the coming few days. A number of flotillas have reached Gaza prior to May 2010, when 10 Turkish activists aboard the Mavi Marmara were killed in an Israeli raid on the six-ship flotilla. Since then, several ships manned by pro-Palestinian activists have tried to reach the shores of Gaza, but they have all been repelled by the Israeli Navy. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped Monday five Palestinians, including a child and a former political prisoner, in different parts of the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. The Israeli army claimed that the child carried an automatic weapon. Later on Monday midday, Israeli troops detained Maysoon Musa, 19, allegedly after stabbing a female Israeli soldier at the 300 Israeli checkpoint separating the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem from Jerusalem. According to media sources, Musa stabbed the soldier in the neck, wounding her severely. The soldier was moved to an Israeli hospital. Troops closed the checkpoint, the only way for the West Bankers in or out of Jerusalem. Later, Israeli forces attacked Musa's house in Al-Shawawra village near Bethlehem and searched it. In other news, Palestinian political prisoner held by the Israeli military, Khadr Adnan, ended a 54-day hunger strike. Adnan ended his strike after the Israeli military agreed to release him on July 12. He was protesting the policy of administrative detention used by the Israeli military to hold Palestinians without charges or trial for unlimited time. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 29th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Negotiations between the European Union and the Greek government broke down over the weekend, and short of a last-minute deal, Greece will default on its debt on Tuesday. The Greek government has stated that they will not make the required payment and called for a national referendum on whether the country wanted to default on the debt and possibly be forced from the EU or to continue with the IMF bailouts and required austerity measures. The European Union leaders have become increasingly hostile toward the Greek government and have stated that even if Greece defaults and leaves the EU, the debt would still have to be repaid. The Greek government responded to the breakdown in talks by issuing capital controls, including shutting the Greek stock market and all banks until the July 5th referendum. ATM machines are still working, but withdrawals are limited to a maximum of 60 euros per day.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur and Ryan Stroyer. The producer is Ethan Martin. Our engineer is Mike Fotopoulos. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Martin.
And I'm Ryan Stroyer. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, it's Alternative Radio with Rob Larson, author of Bleakonomics, speaks on fossil foolishness. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andrae. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio host DeMay Roberts celebrates theater sound design with veteran Portland sound designer Jen Rayanak. At 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Portland abstract painter Judy Cook about Portland in the 1960s and 1970s, design and architecture, and her method idea of solving a painting like a problem. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio. If you are not currently a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for an interview conducted by